Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a straight-talking podcast that's prepared to call a spade an anti-anti-fascist. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
On this episode, we are talking about the British far right. While Steve and I were recording our episode last week, far-right activists were clashing with police in London. Often the far right have benefited from disasters in the past. How are they trying to stoke grievances at the moment, and how are they being handled? We spoke 2 weeks ago, Steve, about Black Lives Matter, about the worldwide protests that have happened over the last week or so. And those protests have mainly been about outrage about police killings, in particular, obviously, the killing of George Floyd. Also, those protests are an outpouring and a seeking to end structural racism and make awareness of structural racism in society. Or how is it then we've ended up with fascists doing Nazi salutes by Winston Churchill's statue?
So obviously, as part of the wider kind of like Black Lives Matter protests and movements from the past few weeks, we had the quite symbolic removal of the statue of Colston from Bristol, where it was pulled, where the statue was pulled down and I think thrown into the sea or something.
Into the river, I think.
River, that was it. Yeah.
I don't think Bristol is a coastal city.
Yeah, yes, a very good point. What am I talking about? Which began a debate about the role of statues and individuals that we should whether or not we should be honouring certain individuals given their connection to slavery, given their past ideals, all of those sorts of things, which has led to some statues being taken down in various areas. There's been a couple of which I think have come down in London. Discussions have been had in other places as well. So I believe now the statue of Cecil Rhodes at one of the Oxford colleges, I think it is.
I think it's Oriel College, I want to say.
Yeah, one of those fancy Oxford colleges has agreed, I believe, now to come down. And Rhodes Must Fall has been a thing for a good few years now. This is as a result of a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests. Rhodes appears to be falling. And off the back of this kind of part of the movement to have a discussion at the very least and to a more extreme extent, pull down and get certain statues removed, there has been a bit of backlash from certain types more leaning towards the right and definitely leaning into the far right to complain about how by targeting statues and pulling them down, we're destroying Britain's history, which in turn has led to the far right trying to defend, quote unquote, these statues from leftists, from socialists, from Black Lives Matter, all in the name of honouring Britain's past and ensuring that Winston Churchill isn't taken down.
It feels to me like that reaction is a bit of a bait and switch, though, because I don't know anyone who's calling for Winston Churchill's statue to come down. But it's been a very good way for many people, let's say in the Conservative Party as well, to ignore the fact that actually the protesters are mainly talking about structural racism and aren't talking about statues. Certainly the far right are using it to sort of stoke grievances and open up another front in a culture war.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, I do not for a second believe that the far right actually really care about these statues for the most part. There were some ridiculous shots, I think, of some far right protesters protecting a statue of George Eliot.
Yes, there was, I think.
Yeah, and it's like, why? Do you think that people are coming for it just because it's a statue? Okay, no, right, you're just trying to make a weird point. Fair enough. dart back slightly to what you said there about no one's actually necessarily really calling for Winston Churchill to be pulled down or anything like that. There's a definite case of the media kind of feeding up on a lot of this because it's quite a sexy story potentially. Private Eye highlighted an interesting little story from one of the local, like Yorkshire, I think it was, newspapers, which basically said there was outrage at the fact that Harold Wilson had a statue because he had some involvement with something that happened in Nigeria, and they ran with this headline, and it was all based off of a single tweet from someone that Private Eye basically said, this is a right-wing troll. That tweet got 9 likes. That was it. But they were running with it because it was a very interesting and quite, you know, here's a local angle on a national story kind of thing, which, yeah, no one is calling for 90% of the statues that have been mentioned to be brought down. And even the ones where you might go, actually, using Churchill as an example, we do need to be a bit more critical of him as an individual and reference that, yes, whilst he was an integral figure during World War II, we can admit also that he was a racist. And like, I think it was Danny Finkelstein from The Times had a good article where he basically said, yeah, people can be more than one thing. Churchill can be a great war leader and a great prime minister and have been a racist. Ernst Bevin can be an integral figure to the NHS and one of the greatest UK politicians, but he was still an anti-Semite.
It was Nye Bevin involved with the NHS, not Ernie Bevin. Ernie Bevin was foreign secretary.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
The point is basically don't have heroes, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get back to the main point of the episode, which was about what the far right are doing to stoke grievances. So we've talked about their sort of bait and switch with focusing on statues. Hope Not Hate have done some very interesting stuff that's looked at the different ways that they've approached the COVID-19, how they've tried to stoke up various, make lots of people very angry. And there's a few different things. I mean, one of them, we've talked about the 5G conspiracies and how some people suggesting that COVID-19 is essentially it's a big smokescreen to arrest lots of celebrities. And actually, Oprah Winfrey had to tweet out that, no, she hadn't been arrested, which I thought was interesting. Lots of attempts to blame migrants. Do you remember Nigel Farage at the start of lockdown? He broke lockdown to go to Dover to record a video about refugees who were coming to Britain.
Yep.
Attempts to stoke anti-China racism, trying to whip up anti-Muslim sentiment as well by essentially showing doctored footage that it's old footage of people attending mosques, which then the far right are claiming is actual footage of Muslims going to mosques at the moment to incite hatred against Muslims. The thing I found interesting actually is the role of Donald Trump in this, and Hope Not Hate sort of indicate that he's a bit of a bulwark figure, I suppose, in the new global far right movement, which you're probably not particularly surprised to hear about, listeners. But therefore, in terms of the attitude of the far right to the pandemic, it's the way in which the attitude shifts of them to the pandemic depending on Trump's response. Because at the start, so we're talking about early March, when Trump is basically tweeting, there's no problem, it's just a flu, everything's fine. There's a lot of downplaying of the pandemic. Whereas later on, when Trump declares a national emergency, that's when you have a massive shift. And that shift is, oh, actually, yeah, we've had better take this seriously. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it is quite interesting to kind of see such a obvious kind of sign that Trump is kind of like shifting the narratives of the far right, and that the minute he changes position on something, suddenly an awful lot of the rest of them do an about face and go, no, we always believed that the coronavirus was a problem. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We've always been at war with Oceania, sir.
It is a bit old-fashioned communist party, isn't it? A bit like Nazi-Soviet pact, but in a very different way, because I suppose then it's the communist party sort of imposing its will from on high. It's a very sort of very top down, like this is the party line, follow it. Whereas this is more organic. It's sort of that type of tonal shift, but playing out in a more dispersed social media environment.
One of the things I found quite interesting is that the far right is not a monolith. It is so many different kind of groups and individuals, a lot of which don't necessarily get on very well, with lots of egos involved, which in turn means that it's very difficult for them to actually organize in a meaningful way that would actually make them a properly serious kind of like threat in the way they have been in the past. The fact is, they would love, as a kind of a group of people or an entity, to be able to kind of fall in line behind a specific person, but they've just not had that one individual to do so, and Trump is the closest they've got. But of course, Trump doesn't really count for like in Britain. He's the American president, so yes, whilst they can find him inspiring or whatever, it's not the same thing as having a British, you know, an Oswald Mosley or somebody like that to get behind. So you end up with them kind of just bending over to try and serve whoever they can as dear leader, because that's just kind of what they're programmed to do.
Let's move on then. Yeah, how are the UK handling the far right? I mean, do we want to talk about the BBC and our allusion to their mealy mouth language that we had at the top of the episode?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the first thing to say is that the way the UK is handling this situation is a bit of a mixed bag in a number of different ways, and we'll kind of go into that, I think, as a bit. But if we start off with the BBC, who aren't having a good time at handling it, I'd say, as essentially, rather than calling a spade, they called them, what was it, anti...
Yeah, there's a couple of things. So there was one where it was police are clashing with anti-fascists, to which one would think there's maybe a more succinct way of putting that. And then also, yeah, anti-racism critics.
Yeah, so the BBC, guided by a focus on impartiality, which is very much being tested by this, because the reason they go for such strained and painful language is because, well, if we call them fascists or racists, you know, suddenly we're making a stance that these people are bad, because everybody knows that fascists are bad, that racists are bad, which they can't do. So they end up tying themselves in knots and coming up with this ridiculous wordplay, which just makes the BBC look ridiculous.
Protesters are raising their arms. And it's like, just call it a Nazi salute.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone knows what it is, guys.
Yeah. Controversial symbol first seen in Fawlty Towers. So yeah, you've got the BBC aspect of it, but you've also got the social media aspect of it. Both Twitter and Facebook have started to take action on some of the stuff that Donald Trump has been doing. So there was a tweet that Donald Trump put out a couple of weeks ago that was actually essentially censored by Twitter, wasn't it? In the sense, because it glorified violence. There's a tweet that he put out earlier this week, which was a doctored CNN video of babies chasing after each other that was manipulated, wasn't it? So, and actually you couldn't see the footage. So there was manipulated media tag put on that tweet. And Facebook have also started removing ads that the Trump campaign's putting out because they've got a red triangle on them, which was a Nazi symbol. And as well as that, from the Katie Hopkins was also permanently suspended from Twitter this week as well. So it looks like social, just a few examples, I suppose, Steve, of social media giants beginning to clamp down on that sort of far right speech on Facebook and Twitter.
The interesting thing in all of this has been the kind of like the difference between how Twitter and Facebook have kind of reacted to this. Now, you can criticize Twitter for an awful lot, maybe at the speed of which they've enacted this, but they've acted. They started censoring and calling out Donald Trump quite openly for breaching their terms of service and the agreement that he has technically made by using their platform when he signed up. More power to them for doing that. That's what I like to see. Facebook, on the other hand, Zuckerberg kind of was tying himself in knots again, trying to weasel out of censoring Donald Trump and taking any action at all. I think for a couple of reasons. One, I think there's a much more conservative leaning audience on Facebook than there is on Twitter. based on the demographics. The kind of the more conservative users on Facebook would be more inclined to leave Facebook, which would have potential of hitting Facebook's ad revenue if Facebook did take a decision to start censoring openly what Donald Trump was posting on there, which is interesting in and of itself for many, many reasons. But it was very interesting to see how Facebook employees responded to this by staging a virtual walkout, which has resulted in, as you mentioned earlier, Facebook actually taking action to start censoring and removing adverts that Donald Trump's campaign and people associated with him are actually running on the site. So we're seeing here a very specific set of actions that Facebook employees have taken, which has shaped Facebook's response and forced them into actually dealing with Trump's tweets and messages.
Yeah, I suppose with Facebook, it feels like it's about the ad revenues as well, because, yeah, as you say, Mark Zuckerberg came out and said, we're not going to censor any political advertising they have, which I suppose is a good way of both maximizing profits for yourself and also creating a dystopia where you can say whatever the hell you like about someone without any reprieve at all. It feels like Twitter as well is trying to grapple with the issue of fake news and disinformation and trying to police the general culture of Twitter, I suppose. So they've brought in new features about you can say you can't reply to this tweet unless you're mentioned, unless you follow a particular person. Or there's even a feature they're trialing, if you retweet an article, it prompts you to say, have you read this article before you've tweeted it out? Because it's very easy to share things. I think we've talked about this as well, haven't we, Steve? Like, it's easy to share things that you haven't read because it makes you feel angry or outraged or good about yourself or something.
That links in quite nicely to people like Katie Hopkins, whose entire shtick and her entire appeal as like as a writer or as a person of interest was based on outrage. She would say something and then everybody would share it because of how ridiculous it was, and people would get angry about it, which in turn would drive kind of like views and interest in whatever websites she'd said it on. So by taking actions to remove or at least lessen some of that focus, essentially Twitter's helping kind of like the UK deal with its Katie Hopkins problem quite massively, because it also makes it very difficult for another Katie Hopkins to arise, because they're trying to encourage people to not give in to rage tweeting, which is essentially what's driven an awful lot of the online far right's presence.
Katie Hopkins is going to make a very interesting case study for whoever starts writing the history of our period in 20, 30 years' time. Not just because she came to write during The Apprentice, which, let's face it, has a lot to answer for. I'm never quite sure, not that it necessarily matters because what she says is vital, but how much she believes it, how much of it is a shtick she puts on because she realises that's a way of having a sort of passable media career.
And I think there's kind of a degree with that with an awful lot of the figureheads in the far right in the UK, is that it's a bit of, well, how much do you actually believe this stuff, and how much of it is just you trying to dupe people out of money or get yourself some cash and some notoriety? Because so I was reading through the Hope Not Hate blog for prep. One of the blogs I read was talking about Paul Golding, I think he's like basically the head of Britain First. And basically what they were implying there was that Golding himself probably doesn't really care that much. He's just utilizing his notoriety and kind of like the views and kind of getting into trouble with the law as fundraisers so that he can continue to live his relatively lavish lifestyle, because every time he gets in trouble with the police, he can raise 50 grand, most of which will not go on to any kind of legal fees or whatever. He will just kind of use that to live. So you do have, I think, amongst a significant part of the far right, individuals who are, I'm sure they do believe to a degree what they're saying, but they're not actually interested in the cause. They're just in it for their own kind of like own ends and lining their own pockets.
Yeah, Tommy Robinson is a similar example of that. And there's been a lot of YouTube accounts as well, haven't there, sensitive far right activists, and that's made a lot of far right YouTubers very unhappy because it's closing down their revenue stream as well.
Yeah, it's quite a common thing, and you are starting to see, I think, across the internet an attempt at least to try and get to grips with a lot of this stuff. Facebook has basically, I think, been the slowest out of the starting blocks on it. But even they're having and being forced into making moves now. So it's going to get a lot more difficult, I think, over the foreseeable future for an awful lot of the far right to organise online in the way that they are currently.
It's probably Nick Clegg just starting to flex his muscles, isn't it, I think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's clearly Clegg's. Clegg's earned a lot of brownie points by towing the Facebook line on Radio 4 every morning. He gets called up to do it. And he's finally gotten through to Zuckerberg and said, Mark, can we just maybe just censor some of the adverts? Let's just remove these ones. It will buy you enough goodwill for a little bit of time that we can work something else out.
We can clamp down on white supremacy, and in return, Mark Zuckerberg can have a plastic bag tax. Apologies to our Lib Dem listeners. I know that's fake news. there's also, and James O'Malley is a very interesting tech writer, writes for things like Gizmodo, I think, and made this point quite eloquently of, you know, am I happy that Katie Hopkins has been suspended by Twitter? Yes, I am. Am I slightly uncomfortable by the fact that you've got essentially a massive company able to affect our online discourse in this way? Yes, I'm also quite uncomfortable about that. I mean, as you say, like, Facebook is where the ad revenues are. It's where a lot of online debate takes place. It's where a lot of online political advertising takes place, in the way that Twitter's quite different, because it's more, it frames elite discourse, but then affects what's reported in the press. But I suppose it's one of those things where governments have been, well, it's almost impossible to regulate, or governments have been very slow to put regulations in place on this kind of stuff. So it ends up being left to self-reported. So you almost need, there must be a happy line between put the Paul Mason line, which is we just have to nationalise all the big tech companies, and the free-for-all Wild West we have at the moment.
There absolutely is. And I think for Facebook in particular, it's a really, I think it's actually a relatively simple solution. You just say, we don't run political ads. Like, if an ad is political, it's really freaking obvious 90% of the time. And unless you're like a third party, a third sector charity group or something, you don't get to tweet about the housing shortage. You don't get to advertise the housing shortage or whatever.
But you do that, and you're going to end up with all sorts of almost like super PAC type things, aren't you? Like, where are you going to draw the line between charities and political? Like,
yeah, there's always going to be work that needs to be done to determine these things. But at the same time, like, it immediately makes it more difficult for them to operate in some capacity. So it immediately cuts down on the amount that can happen. And also buys, like, from a pure PR perspective, gives Facebook a very good, relatively easy win. Would it impact on revenues? Almost certainly. Would it impact a lot? I'll be honest, I don't get, like, as somebody who's really heavily interested in politics, I don't get a lot of political adverts on my Facebook feed. I get a lot of board game things from Kickstarter or kind of like music software production and podcast stuff.
Yeah, that's because of surveillance capitalism, Steve. They know what you'll click on.
Yeah, but that's my point. They also should know I'm, and I do know that they know this, because I've seen the things that they're interested, that I get what my interests are within the back end of Facebook, which everybody can see. Politics is one of the things that's in there, but I don't get that many adverts for it, because I actually don't think there's that many political adverts that are happening.
Well, I think they will increase if we end up with election campaigning in a period of lockdown. But I think the other thing is, if you were to do a blunt instrument like that, what will happen is actually bigger organisations will find a way around that ban with third-party groups. It'll make it harder for smaller organisations and smaller parties who don't have that infrastructure. It reminds me a bit of when the British government tried to clamp down on lobbying a few years ago. And essentially the badly worded bill that they cobbled together was essentially a stick to beat charities and trade unions with, because they were also not allowed to lobby. This is what you're saying, but not necessarily related to the episode. So we should move on with me having the final word. Where do we see the far right going? I mean, you've talked, Steve, a little bit, yeah, about people like Britain First and a lot of very small individual groups that are able to fundraise not insignificant amounts, but don't necessarily make a big dent nationally. We've got Nigel Farage saying that if Brexit isn't sorted by the end of the year, he might restart the Brexit Party, to the surprise of absolutely no one. We're in the middle of a quite deep recession. If we have a no-deal Brexit at the start of the year, it might end up being a long-term recession. Do we think there's does the far right have a chance of a resurgence and playing on people's grievance, do you think?
So I feel like in the UK at least, the kind of like the elements for them to have a resurgence are all there. I think the problem is, as we've kind of alluded to, there's no great unifying figure they can get behind. So like even Nigel Farage is kind of yesterday's news. Like he's been removed from LBC. He's still got a thing on talk radio, I think. He's been given a show there. But he's not the kind of like the political powerhouse he once was. So even if he does bring back the Brexit Party, okay, cool, but like you're not as relevant as you used to be. Tommy Robinson is like not taken seriously really at all and not liked by a number of elements of the far right. Paul Golding of Britain First isn't liked by elements of the far right, and according to Hope Not Hate, was turning up to protests desperately trying to get photos of him shaking hands with people, which in the middle of coronavirus, well done, lads. People just didn't want to do it because they don't like him. And an awful lot of the leading figures are not liked by other leading figures, which means you can't build a meaningful infrastructure, which means you can't build a political arm that's actually going to get anywhere, and you can't actually do anything necessarily that meaningful to actually impact on anything. So whilst I feel like the conditions are right for it, unless a new figurehead emerges, I do not think there is necessarily going to be an increased threat on the political side of things. That is not to say there won't be issues and there won't be problems. It would not surprise me to find, as we kind of progress over the next few years, we see more arrests of people for being members of like groups, prescribed groups like National Action, of which there are a couple of individuals, I think actually in Birmingham, who were prosecuted for that and sent to jail. Including the Miss Hitler beauty pageant entrant, which is apparently a thing. Yeah, I know. There's so little kind of actual potential leadership available to them that if they do go anywhere, it's going to be more towards actual terrorism in some capacity. So you might see more violence, you might see more police, like clashes with the police as they end up in like these kind of protests to protect statues or whatever the new thing ends up being for them. But they're not going to, I can't see them gaining leverage unless they actually end up with a political arm. Because let's remember the last kind of, the two real major, in fact, I think every major kind of fascist kind of moment in British history has always had a political element to it. It was Oswald Mosley, it was the National Front who were running candidates and things, it was the BNP. Like, you can say a similar kind of thing with UKIP and the Brexit Party. Unless you have that element to it as well, to give it a certain degree of political legitimacy, nothing can really happen. I don't feel to massively shift things, but you will see, I suspect, an increase in more extreme tactics as a result.
I mean, there have been foiled plots, haven't there, by far-right activists to murder Labour MPs. Obviously, this weekend is when we celebrate the great get-together in memory of Joe Cox, who was assassinated by a far-right terrorist. I think probably you're right in terms of it being a problem maybe more on the streets in terms of stoking anger and hatred and division, especially if we end up with a longer economic crisis. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you've got ideas of episodes that you'd like us to have on the show, one way of influencing the content we put out is to sign up to our Patreon page, isn't it, Steve?
Yes, you can indeed. You can head over to patreon.com/notenoughchampagne. You can fling us a few quid every month, and it will help us pay for our costs and running the podcast so that we can keep doing this. It will give you access to unique content, some discussions we've been running recently, like early access to episodes, unique episodes that we put out just for our patrons. I think which we're calling Champagners for the time being, which will probably be another 6 months before we start thinking about it again. So congratulations, you're all Champagners for the time being. Yeah, so you head over there, check it out, and yeah, hope to see you in part of the discussions that are going on there.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle's @nochampagnepod. Dave Depper composed our theme tune, and James Cram designed the logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. My Twitter handle is @PaperbackRioter.
Mine's @AcousticRadical.
Happy birthday.